From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, how to help your brain be more efficient and resilient. We talk with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. He's written a new book about how the brain functions, with practical advice about maximizing its potential. Dr. Gupta has been a practicing neurosurgeon for about 20 years. Also, we hear from Maria Ressa, a journalist in the Philippines whose coverage of authoritarian President Rodrigo Duterte has resulted in internet trolls, death threats, criminal charges, jail, and being chosen as Time Magazine's 2018 Person of the Year. She's the subject of a new Frontline documentary called A Thousand Cuts. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new Western that she describes as The Handmaid's Tale meets Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc offers access to licensed therapists by phone or video to help those dealing with stress, anxiety, personal, or family issues. Teladoc is committed to quality, confidential therapy from the comfort of your home, available 7 days a week, matching members to therapists, counselors, and psychiatrists. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers, and individual plans are also available. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/freshair to get started today.
My guest is CNN's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He's written a new book about the brain that explains some of the latest research, debunks myths about brain function, and offers practical advice on improving cognitive function. It's called Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. Dr. Gupta has been a practicing neurosurgeon for about 20 years and is an associate professor of medicine at Emory University School of Medicine. He's performed brain surgery in war zones and disaster zones, including Iraq and Afghanistan. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, welcome to Fresh Air. This is a difficult time with the virus. You know, many people are working at home while schooling their children and doing more housework than ever before because everybody's home. And the people who are working have to work in places where they don't necessarily feel safe. How do you think our brains are being affected by all of the stress of the virus?
It's been really challenging. You know, I think that there is a thing about stress and the brain that has long been documented. And the headline is that stress is not necessarily the enemy. In fact, we need a certain amount of stress. It's what gets us out of bed in the morning, makes us perform well on tests, hopefully, all that sort of stuff. But it is that second adjective you used, unrelenting, that is really problematic here. We need these breaks from stress. You need that constant sort of ebb and flow, and that's what's missing. Again, you don't want it to all be good all the time, but you need to have that sort of up and down to some extent. With things sort of the way that they are, we're sort of in this whiplash sort of time frame with regard to the brain. On one hand, things are getting worse. We see that the numbers continue to get worse over the last few months, and you know, going into the spring, it's likely to continue that trajectory. On the other hand, we also hear that there is a vaccine that is rolling out. It is happening. And that is going to be a significant impact in terms of bringing this pandemic to an end. So it's challenging for the brain right now, but it's important to constantly find times when you can either dramatically reduce your stress, either by thinking about the future with the vaccine and things like that, or other things in your life. But I will say, and this really came out in the book, the idea of eliminating stress, I'm just going to eliminate my stress, it is not obtainable, nor is it necessarily a good idea for the brain.
One of the things people are learning to do now is to live with new routines because you're working at home or teaching your children or getting to work in a different way, having to wear a mask. There's so many new routines that most of us have had to learn. Is that stressful on the brain, having to like reorganize your life and not follow all the predictable patterns that you were used to?
I would argue that it's actually very good for your brain to find new patterns, new routines, and to, you know, mix it up a little bit, shock the brain, shock the body a little bit, not in a bad way, but just in terms of trying different things. Here's the thinking is that when you start to do procedural things over and over again, you can get very good at them. And that's important in a lot of jobs, including, you know, in the operating room where I spend a lot of time. But I think for our brain, we want to constantly be using new paths and trails and roads within our brain. And that can be as simple as just doing something a little differently, eating with your left hand instead of your right hand, if you're right-handed. You know, if you put a tie on in the morning like I do, sometimes closing your eyes and doing it in the dark. The reason being, you're just the more you can recruit different parts of your brain to do even simple activities, the better it is for your brain now and the better it is for your long-term brain health.
A lot of people are multitasking, trying to do two things at once.
Hmm.
Are we fooling ourselves when we're multitasking?
I was surprised by this one. Even though I've been studying the brain for a long time, there was a lot that I learned, and the issues around multitasking were one of them. You know, the idea that you move from one task to another sounds great and very efficient. The issue was that they found you actually divert a fair amount of attention each time you do that. You may not notice it yourself, but when you start to objectively measure this with different types of brain scans, scans that are measuring the function of the brain or particular parts of the brain at any given millisecond, you find that you actually expend quite a bit of energy just to switch from one task to another. So you think you're doing both simultaneously, but you're probably doing neither as well as you could be, and you're probably going to take more time than if you just did them linearly in some way.
You write that two things that have stirred a revolution in neuroscience and our thinking about the brain are, one, the fact that brain cells can regenerate through our lifetimes, and two, that we can change the brain's circuitry through neuroplasticity. What does it mean that brain cells can regenerate through our lifetimes?
We long believed that brain cells, neurons, would only sort of continue to develop or go through this neurogenesis, you know, new brain cell development process at two different times, really when you were very young and still developing your brain as a baby, or if you've had some sort of injury. And at that point, the brain may start to either recruit new brain cells or even grow new brain cells. What we've come to understand over the last decade is that even outside of those two conditions, just in normal life, without an injury or as an adult, you can still grow new brain cells. That was a really pretty significant thing. Before that, the brain was thought to be largely immutable, sort of fixed, you know, and really measured only by its inputs and its outputs, you know, sort of a black box of sorts. We've obviously been able to explore the brain differently, and we've been able to see this neurogenesis, evidence of this neurogenesis, throughout our entire lives, which was really a remarkable finding, and I think very inspiring as well.
So is the act of learning something new what is generating new brain cells?
I think the act of learning new things, the act of experiencing something new, or even doing something that's typical for you but in a different way, can all generate these new brain cells and these new pathways, these new functional pathways throughout the brain. And I think that's the most critical thing, is that you can use the same roads and go to the same buildings you always go to, and pretty soon you'll be really good at that. That's the practice makes perfect part of things. But as you have these new experiences, these new learnings, these new activities, whatever they may be, something that gets you out of your comfort zone, maybe is how I described it, you will start to build new things within your brain.
A lot of people assume you kind of lose the ability to learn new things at a certain age or to create new habits or new patterns of behavior. Is that true?
I really don't think that that's true. I mean, it would be fair to say that, you know, the brain, like any other organ, if you were to look at it, it ages. That shouldn't surprise anybody. It ages. It's going to change. The brain itself, just the physical matter of the brain, is going to change as you get older. But in terms of what it can do, processing speed, the ability to learn new things, all of that, that is not limited. Perhaps some of your senses start to diminish, your eyesight, you may need reading glasses, your hearing, things like that. But your ability to actually be able to process, to understand, to apply, that really, not only does it not change, it can actually get sharper, can get better as you get older if you continue to use it. It is sort of the use it or lose it phenomenon when it comes to the brain, if you think of the brain like a muscle, which I think is a fair metaphor.
Do you think a healthy brain is measured by how well you can memorize things? How do you measure what a healthy brain is?
I think a healthy brain is really measured by beyond the basic critical functions of being able to get you through your day, the activities of daily living, all those things. It's really about your happiness and how much joy you have. I know, which sounds euphemistic, but if your brain is designed to obviously take care of the critical functions, breathing, respiration, heart rate, blood pressure, things like that, your brainstem functions. Beyond that, it's the things that get you through the day and create the most positive living experience you can have. That's really what the brain should be doing if the brain is working well and we're treating the brain right.
So your brain shouldn't be saying you didn't do a good enough job, nobody likes you. That's not a healthy brain.
That's a toxic brain.
That's a toxic brain, right.
That's a toxic brain. And we all live with that because we live in a society in which that is what we're exposed to often. But the brain left to its own devices has one purpose, and it's to just serve the individual. And so how does any organ serve you? You wouldn't ask about the heart that way. A happy heart is a healthy heart. A happy brain is a healthy brain. But they all exist to serve the individual. That's it, to serve no one else.
My guest is Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. His new book is called Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. We'll hear more of our interview after a short break, and book critic Maureen Corrigan will review the new Western novel, Outlawed. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Dr. Anthony Fauci will receive WHYY's 2021 Lifelong Learning Award Wednesday, February 3rd, and we're inviting you to be part of this special evening, featuring a live interview of Dr. Fauci by Terry Gross, host and co-executive producer of Fresh Air. Proceeds from ticket sales to this virtual event support WHYY's commitment to lifelong learning and civic engagement through storytelling, education, and community conversations. Get yours today at whyy.org/lifelonglearning.
Let's get back to my interview with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. He's also been a practicing neurosurgeon for about 20 years. His new book is all about the brain. He debunks myths, explains the latest research about the brain's ability to keep learning new things, no matter what your age, and how to keep the brain healthy and functioning at its best. So it's encouraging to hear you say that you can keep creating new pathways in your brain. You could do it even when you're older. Let me balance that with the discouraging news that age 24 is the peak from your brain. So is it all downhill after 24?
I think the idea that we have these sort of artificial peaks in terms of what the brain can and cannot do is already starting to become a little bit antiquated thinking. It was only over the last decade or so, Terry, that we even thought that the brain could create new brain cells and become more plastic. So we had this sort of image in our head that, you know, it was this peak performance at a certain age and then sort of downhill after that. I don't want to be hyperbolic or euphemistic. I mean, it is true that our organs age and we age, and that's true. That's part of life. But the brain, perhaps more than any other organ, I think can actually become better as we get older. There's certain things that are, going to diminish. Our senses, for example. When it comes to things like judgment, when it comes to language, when it comes to your overall capacity to find happiness, those things can actually improve as you get older. And I keep coming back to this happiness and joy thing because oftentimes people think about these types of lifestyle changes in terms of preventing illness later. But when we really look at this, we find that there's benefit to doing these things right now for your brain. Like if I tell you to eat right and exercise and don't smoke and do all those things and nothing will happen to you. Well, first of all, that's not the most inspiring, right? You do all these things, you work so hard, and then nothing happens to me? Why am I doing it? Well, to prevent illness. Well, how do I know that I wouldn't have had the illness anyway? How do I know it was all this hard work that I did? The brain is different in that you can close the loop right now. You can feel better right away as a result of these actions. And one of the ways that you feel better is you feel happier. You feel more productive. You feel like a better daughter, better son, better spouse, whatever it may be. You want to get out of bed in the morning. You feel like you have a life of purpose. Whatever it is, those things you can feel now as a result of these things, which I just think is important. You know, as a doc, we're always trying to inspire our patients to do the right thing by telling them this will help you 20, 30 years from now. It's pretty tough to make the case. If I tell you that it's going to help you right now, and by the way that it helps is that it makes you feel happier, it's pretty compelling.
Two really important things for a healthy brain are exercise, which you've talked about. That kind of surprised me. I never really associated that with the brain. But also sleep. Sleep is really important for good brain function. What happens while we're sleeping?
The brain is not at rest the way people might imagine it to be when we're sleeping. I think a lot of people, you know, they realize that we dream and we do other things, so the brain can be quite active. But I think there's several important things that are happening, but two that I really focused on. One is that is the time when we really do consolidate memories. So you've had all these interesting experiences throughout your day, people that you've met, conversations you've had, experiences you've had, whatever it may be. You have these things in part because you want to remember them and add them to your life narrative. That process of actually putting them in the memory book, if you will, putting them in the Terry Gross life narrative book, really happens at the time that you sleep. That's the consolidation of memory sort of phase. Some of it is actually placing the memory. Some of it is moving memories from short-term to longer-term memory and those sorts of things. So you have to be able to sleep well in order to remember well. And you also have to be able to sleep well in order to forget well, because you want to, in order to make that life narrative as cohesive as possible, you're doing a lot of editing along the way. You're getting rid of some things, you're adding things, the whole process, just like you might write a paper. A lot of that's happening while you sleep. Another more recent finding about sleep is that there is a sort of rinse cycle that's happening when you sleep, a rinse cycle that allows certain neurotrophic factors to bathe the brain, but also to remove certain waste as well from the basic metabolic processes that are happening in the organ, the brain, just like any other organ in the body. It's almost like the lymphatic system in the body. The lymphatic system is draining lymph, you know, in your lymph, draining waste away from your body. That's happening in the brain as well. So during sleep, it's really this consolidation of memories, this removal of waste, and this nourishing of the brain that takes place more efficiently than at any other time during the day.
Do you think that memory games and crossword puzzles are actually helpful in training your brain to remember more things and be sharper?
I think that crossword puzzles and brain training exercises can be quite helpful at making the roads in your brain that you use a lot already, keeping them strong, preventing them from needing construction and things like that. It's kind of the practice makes perfect part of your brain. And some of the brain games can actually increase your processing speed, the speed at which you'll process new content and new information. But I really do draw a line between that and keeping a brain sharper and building cognitive reserve throughout your life. That's different. You want to be doing different things in order to build that reserve as opposed to doing the same thing better and better. There's a role for both, but if it's cognitive reserve you're looking for, doing different things, things that get you outside your comfort zone, is probably going to have a much bigger payoff.
So to sum up, for a healthy brain, you recommend movement. You like the idea of strenuous exercise you recommend a good healthy diet and say that a heart healthy diet is also a brain healthy diet. Get a lot of sleep. How much would you suggest?
I think sleep-wise, 7 to 9 hours seems like the right amount. Everyone is...
Nine hours.
7 to 9 hours. If you can do it, if you can do it. You know, if you're dreaming in the morning, if you're dreaming in the morning right before you wake up, that's a pretty good sign. That probably means that you've spent a fair amount of your evening, your night, consolidating memories and going through the rinse cycle and... You know, you wake up with some morning dreams. If you can do that, that's a pretty good sign. Everyone's different, and that's something that I really try to focus on in the book as well, because we love this sort of blanket advice on things. But yeah, 7 billion people on the planet, we're all going to be a little different. But if you want to put a range on things, 7 to 9 hours of sleep.
Give me the honest answer to this question. How many hours of sleep do you get between performing brain surgery and being a CNN medical correspondent and a father of three?
Yeah, you know, Terry, I'm not getting enough sleep. And, you know, I hate to be one of those people who's not practicing what he preaches, but even though I think I know the right thing to do doesn't mean that I always do it. And I'm just very honest and transparent about that. It's been a really hard year. I mean,
I know.
It's been a really tough year. I mean, since the beginning of 2020, Terry, I have been every day, weekends included, waking up around 5 o'clock in the morning, sometimes 4:45. Part of the reason is I need to speak to people on the other side of the globe, and they're ending their days as I'm beginning mine, and I want to speak to them. You know, I wanted to speak to folks in China from where the virus, you know, they had some of the earliest data. I wanted to speak to them about the outbreak. I wanted to speak to them about their vaccine development. Were the antivirals working? How are the hospitals doing? What are they learning in terms of critical care? I mean, I was so head down into this story. I'm a neurosurgeon, not an infectious disease doctor, but nothing really mattered when you're dealing with a novel virus. There's so much that we're still learning. So I became so head down in this story and this issue and learning everything about it that I was waking up at 4:45 in the morning. And because I do television, sometimes the shows don't go off the air till 11 o'clock at night. You know, I'm getting 5 or 6 hours a night for a year. And it's affected me for sure. It's not ideal.
How has it affected you?
I'm not as clear. I'm not as happy. I'm tired. I'm not as organized. I'm a super organized, fastidious individual. I mean, that is kind of my calling card. Everything is always organized. Right now, I'm sitting here talking to you in my basement closet. I don't even know if I have my shirt on inside out or not as I'm talking. Luckily, you can't see me. I have a little cot that I put down here in my basement room. Windowless basement room where I sleep a lot. It's littered with shirts that probably need to be washed and ties and papers from this year, things that I continue to want to read as we're moving into the next phase of this pandemic. I have all these notes about the vaccine. I got my own vaccine. I took copious notes on the vaccine before I received it myself. It's my mind and my space are cluttered. And I know that I could be a lot better if I simply got sleep. And I'm not being hyperbolic. It's true. But I've just had a hard time getting there this year.
Understood. Why are you sleeping on a cot in the basement?
Well, because a lot of times I don't want to wake up my family. I have two dogs. I have three kids, my wife. And if I'm going to bed around midnight and need to be back up at 4:45, all that means is I'm going to wake up the whole house twice. So the dogs start barking if I go upstairs, and that wakes up the girls, and you know, it's just no one's happy in that case. So at least I can be the only one unhappy with that scenario by simply sleep. I don't sleep there all the time, but there's a lot of times when I just, you know, it's just easier, especially if there's a lot going on. The kids have Zoom school in the morning and tests and things like that. It's easier. I'm privileged, I think, to be able to work from home. So I can see the family, you know, a fair amount. I can pop up during the day and say hi and sometimes have meals together. But most of the time, I'm in this windowless basement. It's sort of this sensory-deprived environment, which just everywhere I look, I mean, I got Post-its all over the walls. Everywhere you look, it's COVID. I'm totally immersed in the world of COVID.
Well, Dr. Gupta, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you. What an honor.
Dr. Sanjay Gupta is a neurosurgeon and CNN's chief medical correspondent. His new book is called Keep Sharp, Build a Better Brain at Any Age. If you're feeling confined these days, our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a new novel to recommend that she says gallops off into uncharted territory. It's an updated Western called Outlawed. Here's Maureen's review.
Talking to friends this past week, I've described Anna North's new novel, Outlawed, as The Handmaid's Tale meets Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That's a glib tagline, but there's some justification for it. Outlawed opens in an alternative America of 1894 that was torn asunder by a flu epidemic some 60 years earlier. West of the Mississippi, centralized government has been replaced by a patchwork of independent towns. One of the few things this fragmented America agrees on is that women are put on earth to bear children. That's it. And because too much knowledge, especially medical knowledge of women's bodies, is frowned upon, barren women are regarded as freaks of nature, witches. They're ostracized, imprisoned, and sometimes put to death. That status quo is pretty much okay with the heroine of Outlawed, a 17-year-old woman named Ada. She's content to be married off to a man chosen for her and settles in to await her first pregnancy, which fails to happen. In less than a year, Ada is expelled from her husband's house and, after a few twists of fate, joins up with the infamous hole-in-the-wall gang. In North's novel, that real-life band of 19th-century gunslingers is reimagined as a group of mostly non-conforming gender outlaws who identify as female or non-binary. They're led by a messianic figure called the Kid. In finding a home with the gang, Ada comes to realize that sexual desire can roam as wide and free as deer and buffalo on the range. Outlawed in this quick summary can sound gimmicky, but there's much more going on in this smart adventure tale than just a sly upending of the traditional Western, rooted in macho individualism and violence. For all the ways North ingeniously stretches the limits of the genre, she's also clearly a fan. She doesn't shy away from the expected gunfights, and her rendering of such scenes is jittery and absorbing. But North also dwells on the bloody aftermath of these shootouts and the damage that bullets do to the body. In common with writers of classic Westerns, North also evokes the rugged landscape of the West, especially the area around the gang's hideout, with its salt flats, prairie dog burrows, and notched wall of bright red rock many stories high that gives the hole-in-the-wall gang its name. It's there that the final showdown between the gang and the posse of lawmen who are pursuing them will take place. Most of all, though, it's the affecting character of Ada who's the steady draw here. Once fate tosses her out of her complacent life, Ada, in the time-honored tradition of the Western, becomes a hunter. Like Mattie Ross in True Grit, or dare I say Ethan Edwards in the vexed John Ford film The Searchers, Ada is on the trail, not of someone, but of something. She wants medical knowledge of women's bodies. Ada joins the gang for protection, but also to get loot from the holdups, to be able to travel and study with a master midwife she's heard about, a woman who practices farther west. Ada aims to save other infertile women from being ostracized or murdered. There's a moment after she settles in with the gang when Ada almost decides to stay put. She tells us, "I saw how the valley, now blooming into beauty after the long winter, could feel like home. What I had planned instead was so amorphous and uncertain. But if I stayed in the valley, I would learn no more about myself or people like me than I had known when I left. I would die without knowing what made me the way I was." The heroes of the traditional Western were always sure about what made them the way they were, what made a man a man. For Ada and the other outlaws of this spirited novel, the frontiers of gender and sexuality beckon to be explored.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Outlawed by Anna North. After we take a short break, we'll hear from journalist Maria Ressa. She's the executive editor and CEO of Rappler, an online media organization based in Manila. The authoritarian president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, has threatened to shut Rappler down, and he's warned journalists they're not safe from assassination. Ressa is now facing the possibility of several years in prison. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
LifeKit is always here with tips about personal finance and health, but also for those tough discussions, like what to tell your kids when the news gets scary. Listen now to the LifeKit podcast from NPR.
The news moves fast. Listen to the NPR News Now podcast to keep up. We update stories as they evolve every hour. So no matter when you listen, you get the news as close to live as possible on your schedule. Subscribe to or follow the NPR News Now podcast.
At a time when many journalists are facing increasing threats around the world, my guest Maria Ressa has stood up to one of the world's most dangerous leaders. Ressa is a co-founder and executive editor of Rappler, an online media organization based in Manila. She's been covering the rise of the populist authoritarian president Rodrigo Duterte since he was a mayor in the Philippines. When he became president in 2016, Ressa and her reporters covered Duterte's bloody war on drugs, his expanding grip on all parts of the government, and his crackdown on the press. Ressa and Rappler have faced 13 government investigations. She now faces 9 criminal charges. In June, Ressa and another reporter were convicted of cyber libel, defaming someone online. It's a Filipino law that's being applied retroactively because the law didn't even exist when the alleged crime was committed. They are appealing and are still fighting other charges. They also face constant threats of assassination and jail from Duterte, his supporters, and the army of internet trolls they unleash. Ressa sees this abuse of power and the weaponized use of the internet as a danger to democracies everywhere. Maria Ressa was born in the Philippines and grew up in the U.S. She worked for CNN for 2 decades. She ran CNN's bureau in Manila and then the Jakarta Bureau, and served as CNN's lead investigative reporter focusing on terrorism in the region. Ressa decided to make Manila her home and created Rappler. Her fearless work has garnered attention worldwide. Now there's a documentary about her work called 1,000 Cuts, directed by Ramona Diaz. It's available online at pbs.org and on YouTube. Maria Ressa, welcome to Fresh Air, and I so admire your courage and the journalism that you have been doing. So thank you for coming on our show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to quote some of the things that President Duterte has said. And this first one got a lot of applause. He said, "If you don't kill me now, 4 months from now, I'll roast you like a pig." He said, "Just because you're a journalist, you think you're exempted from assassination?" In a speech, he said, "When I became president, I said, 'Do not do drugs because I will kill you. I have 3 more years. I'm really going to finish you off. You'll see. At his inaugural address, he said, "If you're into drugs, someday you'll make a mistake and I will kill you." It's just horrifying to hear a president speak about killing his citizens like that. Do you take him at his word, especially with journalists, saying that just because you're a journalist, you're not exempt from assassination?
I think that's the one thing he's always delivered, his threats. You know, the funny thing is, in 2015, which was when we were trying to figure out, was he really going to run or not? I sat down with him, and that was the first time I'd interviewed him since 1989. So I interviewed him a long, long time ago, and then in 2015. And in that interview, he admitted that he killed three people on camera, you know? And at that point, maybe the way American journalists covered Trump, it was like, I didn't quite know what to think or how to react. But since then, every quote that you've said, it creates a new beginning of how the president uses his power, right? He doesn't lie about it. He threatens, and you know, he creates a list of people he says are drug addicts. And in that, he gave me this list. This is now in 2016, December 2016, he's already president. We're sitting at the palace and he gives me a thick list, like almost a foot long. And he says, these are all the drug addicts. And I was like, is this proven? He said, well, no, not yet. But then slowly over the next few years, those people on that drug list, they wound up dead. I think the difference between the United States and the Philippines, between Trump and Duterte, is you have institutions. And while Americans say that your institutions aren't strong enough, they were strong enough to hold a strong president. We have a president who's boasted of killing people and continues to encourage the police and the military to kill people. We don't know what to do with that.
In one of your interviews with President Duterte, you said to him, you break the law. You threaten to break the law. You've said you killed, and yet you have the task of keeping the rule of law. Is it important that people be afraid of you? And he answered, yes, for the rule of law, there must be fear. So that's a very brave question to have asked him, especially since his government has been investigating and threatening you. What is it like for you to confront him with questions like that?
You know, that was December of 2016, and I was one of four reporters that he gave an interview to at the palace. With President Duterte at that point, I was really curious because he believes that he understands the Filipino psyche. And really, his understanding of the psyche is all about bullying. He believes that Filipinos do not follow the law and that they must be threatened into doing that. I had asked him earlier, you know, how are you going to make this country? We're 110 million people and it's been a tough democracy that's kind of, you know, had weak institutions, weak law enforcement, endemic corruption. How are you going to handle this? And he says, no, I'll be different because I know how the Filipinos think. And then he said how he would use institutions like the tax agency to run after and make Filipinos follow. Well, little did I know then that the tax agency would come after me because I'm doing my job, right? I face 5 tax evasion cases that the government has filed. And all because we've been reclassified from a news organization to a stock brokerage. Like, let me think of the exact. Yeah. See, this is what, when I actually go into it, I just go, oh my God. Well, we were reclassified as a dealer in securities. That's the exact quote. So Rappler as an entity is not a news organization. We are a, quote, dealer in securities. And because we are, we then should have paid all the taxes that a stock brokerage agency would, right? That makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Well, that makes as much sense as being tried retroactively for a law that didn't exist when the so-called crime was committed, which is what happened to you with the libel case. So it is really remarkable what you're facing now. In the U.S., a lot of people who do not support Trump have been asking, what is the appeal of somebody who has made so many baseless claims, who has threatened journalists, and who often seems to have no interest in actually governing? And I'm wondering if you have figured out, what is the appeal of Duterte? Because he has a lot of followers.
Yes, he does. I think there are two things, and one of our reporters actually says this in the film. Populism brings an illusion of power to people who may feel powerless. And our reporter in the film said he promises revenge. So it's, again, that split of the haves versus the have-nots. There's a big gap between the rich and the poor in the Philippines. And President Duterte has styled himself as coming from the poor, even though that's not actually true, right? His supporters will say he's like someone you can have a beer with. But he is in his 70s, so he is sexist at best. He's a misogynist at worst. And he says things that you would never expect to come from a leader's mouth.
I want to hear more about how you think Duterte's attacks on journalists and attacks on other people who oppose him have changed your approach to journalism as the executive editor of The Rappler.
That's a great question. I'll say it from experience, right? So the first target of attack, the woman who went to jail early on in February 2017, was Senator Laila De Lima, former Justice Secretary, former head of the Commission on Human Rights. She investigated Duterte when he was still mayor for extrajudicial killings. When the government was throwing all the charges against her, that she was a drug dealer, that was a charge thrown against her, we were reporting it as if it was still the old world. And I guess there was a part of me that was thinking that, would the government really say all these things if they didn't have the evidence? So it's your question about, now it's happening to me, right? Yes. The response is, yes, the government will do it, even if they have no evidence. In fact, the president, just in December, President Duterte, named lawmakers who he said were corrupt. And then the next sentence is, but I have no evidence. He still named them. And they were then forced to defend themselves the next day, right? So how does it change the way we report? So the first is, you become very skeptical of government and its processes. Like in December, when the president named these lawmakers, we didn't print those names. Because when he said there is no evidence, why would you print them? But in the old days, you would print them because he's the president, right? So I guess the norms have changed in that sense. And then the second one is, in my case, I think the big shift for me is I've realized that when you're in a battle for facts, journalism is activism. And that's a big shift because I grew up a traditional journalist. I helped write the standards and ethics of three different news groups, right? So getting to that point where it was actually when I was arrested. And after they detained me and held me overnight, they made a point to arrest me when courts closed. And it was February 13th because the next day was Valentine's Day, right? It's February 13th, 2018. And I couldn't post bail. It was too late to post bail, so I had to stay the night in jail. And the next day when I came out, I was so angry because the government's power was used to make me feel its power, to intimidate me. That was the goal. And that's when I realized I don't have to ask anyone else whether you've done anything wrong. I don't have to look for it. I know this. So that's when I began to speak, and I actually realized in this day and age, you have to call it. You have to say a lie is a lie. You have to challenge in ways that we traditional journalists are uncomfortable with.
Part of your arrest is filmed for the documentary, and you speak to the press after you're arrested. And you are so cool and so calm. And your thoughts are so kind of organized when you make those comments. And I was watching it thinking, how does she do that? How does she remain calm at a time like this and just, you know, say what she needs to say?
I was so angry. You know, when I watched that, when I watched the film, it was like getting punched in the gut. Because when you live through it, it's like it happens in slow motion and you take it and you move on. You know, I live my life step by step. I know which direction I need to go in. That particular one, I was detained overnight. There's several of these now. I don't know which one it was. But in each one, I know that I need to tamp down the anger. It's kind of like doing a live shot. Right. This is a good thing that I guess I took from 20 years with CNN and doing live shots. All hell can be breaking loose around you, and you have to take what you know, push your emotion down, and have clarity of thought. And like a live shot, I pegged to what are the three main things that I want to say, and that's how I speak. The worse it is, the calmer I get.
That is so interesting that your CNN experience doing live reporting helped you. It makes a lot of sense. On a related note, do you think that the cameras from the documentary about you, the other cameras from the press, do you think that they protect you in any way? Or do they make things worse because it calls more attention to you?
No, they protect. You know, at the beginning, if you come under attack, you think that, you know, just be quiet. You, at least that's the impact in the Philippines of President Duterte. You try to just do your jobs, but that's not the way it works. And to me, it all came to a head in December of 2018 when Time made me one of the covers for the Person of the Year. And I didn't know that was going to happen. So the first time I saw it was a tweet. And when it came out, I was like, oh my gosh. The first thing I did was I thought it was false. So I sent it to our social media team to verify. But when I got the call, I thought, oh my gosh, now I'm really going to be targeted. I already was targeted. And what I didn't realize and what I embraced later on is that was a shield. And that's the same thing with the documentary film. Washington Post, I think their new banner says it, right? Democracy dies in darkness. Staying quiet when the Constitution is being violated, when your rights are being violated, that doesn't help anyone. And I guess that's the lesson I've learned, that whatever it is, call it, shine the light. Because if you don't, it's going to happen over and over again.
You face 9 criminal charges now. You were found guilty of cyber libel. You faced the possibility of 6 years in prison. How likely are you to actually be in prison for 6 years?
I don't know. And I guess that's part of what's difficult about the last few years. That's only one of the 9 criminal cases that have been filed against me. All of them, of course, politically motivated. I've done nothing wrong but be a journalist. Having said that, all the charges combined could send me to jail for 100 years. I mean, the rest of my life. And how likely is it? You know, let me put it this way. It's like how I live my life today, how I fight the battle today, will make it more or less likely that I go to jail, right? And that's why in a strange way, I think that the battle is the journey. The journey is the battle, if that makes sense. I feel like what I do today will make a difference, will determine what my future is going to be like. And that, I guess that's a good thing. it's late at night my time, right? But
oh, yes, it's 11 o'clock your time at night. Yeah.
Yeah. I think... I don't know what the future will look like, but I do know that every day that we hold the line, every day that we hold power to account, makes it more certain that we will remain a democracy and that I stay out of jail.
Well, listen, I wish you safety. I hope you stay out of prison, and I hope you stay healthy. Thank you for the work that you do. You're a very courageous woman.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and for listening to me.
Maria Ressa is the executive editor and CEO of Rappler, an online media organization based in Manila. A PBS Frontline documentary about her called A Thousand Cuts, directed by Ramona Diaz, is available online at pbs.org and on YouTube. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with assistance today from Mike Villers. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.